Listening to Confession, Chapter 31, Paragraph 2. As magistrates may lawfully call a synod of ministers and other fit persons to consult and advise with about matters of religion, so if magistrates be open enemies to the Church, the ministers of Christ of themselves, by virtue of their office, or they with other fit persons, upon delegation from their churches, may meet together in such assemblies. So here we're looking at the calling of synods and how synods or wider church assemblies, assemblies of ministers and elders, can and should be called. And in 1647, when the General Assembly adopted the Westminster Confession to replace the briefer 1560 Scots Confession, they added an explanatory note concerning this particular paragraph, so that in the Act of Assembly, it met in Edinburgh on August 27, 1647, the Act approving the Confession of Faith, which had been drawn up in London with the Scots commissioners present, they include this statement, and I'll read it in full. It is quite long, but please bear with me. But lest our intention and meaning be in some particulars misunderstood, it is hereby expressly declared and provided that the not mentioning in this confession of the several sorts of ecclesiastical officers and assemblies shall be no prejudice to the truth of Christ in these particulars to be expressed fully in the Directory of Government. It is further declared that the Assembly understand that some parts of the second article of the 31 chapter only of Kirks not settled or constituted in point of government, and that although in such Kirks a synod of ministers and other fit persons may be called by the magistrate's authority and nomination without any other call to consult and advise with about matters of religion, and although likewise the ministers of Christ without delegation from their churches may of themselves and by virtue of their office meet together synodically in such Kirks not yet constituted, yet neither of these ought to be done in Kirks constituted and settled, it being always free to the magistrate to advise with synods of ministers and ruling elders meeting upon delegation from their churches, either ordinarily or being indicted by his authority occasionally and pro renata, it being also free to assemble together synodically as well as pro renata as at the ordinary times upon delegation from the churches by the intrinsical power received from Christ as often as it is necessary for the good of the church so to assemble in case the magistrate to the detriment of the church withhold or deny his consent. The necessity of occasional assemblies being first remonstrated unto him by humble supplication. Well, that's a very long quotation, but they wanted to make certain things very clear, and there were certain things that they thought were not sufficiently clear in this paragraph. The assembly of 1560, back at the Reformation, when the Scots Confession was drawn up, it had been called independently of the monarch or civil power. This 1647 Act approving the Confession with this clarification statement, this also explains why the Reformed Presbyterian Church in its ordination vows requires, do you believe the doctrines contained in the Westminster Confession of Faith as received by the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland in the year 1647. In other words, the Reformed Presbyterian Church requires its office bearers to accept everything taught in the Confession of Faith, and is also receiving it with the clarification given in the Scottish Church. So then, first of all, the magistrate may call a synod of ministers and elders. But as the Scottish Church clarified, this should only be done in a kirk or church, kirk, the old Scots word for church, in a kirk not settled and constituted in point of government. That is, when there is disorder and confusion and no settled church government, the magistrate may, as it were, kick-start the settlement of the church by calling known ministers and rulers in the church together in order to settle the church's government on an independent footing from the civil power. This is why the Scots and many Puritans were willing to attend the Westminster Assembly, even though it was called by Parliament, because they recognised that there was need to establish what order and government the church should have. Where that hasn't been settled, then there's no obvious body to call such an assembly. And so when Parliament called the Westminster Assembly and the Solemn League and Covenant enlarged the work of that assembly, the ground to be covered, they attended it. The text given, Isaiah 49, verse 23, "And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lift up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me." Here kings and queens, rulers, are seeking the good of the church, and thus helping forward its establishing its separate and distinct government, because Christ has appointed a government in the church, in church offices, distinct from the civil magistrate. So it is legitimate where the church is in disarray for the Christian ruler to assist in facilitating the organizing of its own separate, distinct government. 1 Timothy chapter 2, and verses 1 and 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1 and 2. "I exhort therefore that, first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty." Now, this is telling us what to pray for, and it includes or who to pray for, and it specifically mentions kings. We're to pray for all kinds of people, but we are to pray for kings and for those in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. What we pray for, kings and those in authority ought to provide. And in other words, when we pray for civil government that will facilitate the church and the people of God in their lawful following of Christ and his truth, it must be the duty of rulers to provide such circumstances. So kings and rulers are to provide circumstances not only for the individual believer, but for the church to pursue godliness, to pursue its appointed end and calling, and therefore to settle its own government. And so the state may help the church to be in a position to settle its government, but without interfering in it. Then 2 Chronicles chapter 19, 2 Chronicles chapter 19 and verse 8 to 11. 2 Chronicles 19, verse 8 to 11. Verse 8. Moreover, in Jerusalem did Jehoshaphat set the Levites, and of the priests, and of the chief of the fathers of Israel, for the judgment of the Lord, and for controversies, when they returned to Jerusalem. And he charged them, saying, Thus shall ye do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully, and with a perfect heart. And what cause soever shall come to you of your brethren that dwell in their cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and judgments, ye shall even warn them that they trespass not against the law, and so wrath come upon you and upon your brethren. This do, and ye shall not trespass. And behold, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites shall be officers before you. Deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good. Here the king is helping to establish church order without usurping a role in the church, and it distinguishes between the matters of the Lord and the matters of the king. Not because the matters of the king, as if the king had nothing to do with the Lord and was to rule independently of the Lord. But by the matters of the Lord, it means those things more immediately relating to the worship of the Lord. Another proof text given, 2 Chronicles 29 and 30, deals with two full chapters. So we'll not read them, but Hezekiah cleansed the temple and proclaimed a Passover after there had been much disorder in the worship of the Lord. Then the confession gives Matthew chapter 2 and verse 4 and 5. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, that's Herod, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet. No doubt this text is given to indicate that rulers may consult the church on relevant matters. Herod was doing it in wickedness, of course, but had his profession of a desire to worship the Lord been true, then it would have been legitimate for him to consult the officers of the church. Proverbs chapter 11 verse 14 is given, simply giving a general principle. Proverbs 11:14, where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors there is safety. So that's the general principle, that and therefore applying that to rulers. If rulers need advice from the church, if they want to do what's right before God, if they want to know what the Bible teaches about how they should rule, then they should consult the Church of God. The Reformed position on church and state is that the state under God upholds God's law, both tables, to facilitate the church, and the church in exercising its role to hold forth the truth of God, the whole counsel of God, also teaches the civil ruler his responsibility. So then, secondly, the church may call assemblies under Christ independently of the state. The church may call assemblies under Christ independently of the state. Acts chapter 15, we looked at this last week. Acts chapter 15 and verse 2. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. And being brought on their way by the church, they passed through, and so on. Verse 4, and when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. Here a synod is called without any reference to the civil power. And then verse 22, then pleased it the apostles and elders and the whole church to send chosen men of their own company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, namely Judas, surnamed Barsabbas, and Silas, chief men among the brethren. And they wrote letters by them after this manner: the apostles and elders and brethren send greeting unto the brethren which are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia. Verse 25, it seemed good unto us, being assembled with one accord, to send chosen men unto you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul, and so on. Here it's quite obvious that the synod was called without reference to the civil power. It was called and deliberated without the presence of the civil power. It made decisions which were not dependent upon the approval of the civil power. So the confession refers this to when the magistrate is an open enemy of the church, but the Scots Assembly, to avoid all confusion, added that the church has the power from Christ to organize, to call such assemblies, such synods, independently anyway, but to do so with the agreement of the civil power, if that can be done. I'm sure to us here today, this all seems quite strange. We live in a day when Orthodox Christianity is so small scale, and the idea that the civil authorities have an interest in establishing the Reformed faith and in helping the church, it's so far away from anything that we have known. The Westminster Assembly met in a different day. It met in a day when there were godly men even in Parliament, when Christianity was the acknowledged religion within the country, and where they were seeking to have an ordered Reformed church throughout the three kingdoms of England, Scotland and Ireland. And when ministers, not only the eminent Puritan preachers like Arrowsmith and Tweed and others, preached to the Houses of Parliament, but the visiting Scottish ministers, Rutherford, Gillespie, Henderson, all preached to the Houses of Parliament in London. These things are so far away from us in our present situation that it's difficult for us to altogether understand what they were driving at here, because the civil rulers today have the slightest interest in establishing a nationwide biblical and reformed church. Nevertheless, we should have our principles in place. We long for a better day. We long for a day when the people of God are so numerous within the land that even those in authority have a desire to honor Christ and to seek the good of the church. Nevertheless, the church is not dependent on the civil power for its right of assembling for church government, though it is in all things to seek to do things peaceably with the state as far as it can be done without dishonoring Christ. The history of the church in Scotland, perhaps more than anywhere else, has been one of struggle over this question. On the one hand, wanting that Christ be recognized as king over the nation as well as the church, and yet on the other hand, seeking to maintain the independent government of the church without state interference. It is a very high ideal, but it is a biblical ideal and one that we should hold on to. The church does not govern the state, as in Roman Catholicism. The state does not govern the church, as in Anglicanism. The state and church don't have nothing to do with each other, as in voluntarism and the general or independent approach to things, although the Puritan independents didn't believe that. The church and the state are both under Christ with duties one toward another. The state to help the church, but not to infringe its independent government. And the church to advise and teach the civil ruler so that they know the will of the Lord. That ideal explains a great deal of the struggle of the Church of God in Scotland and here and in England, but perhaps nowhere has it been so fierce a battle as in Scotland. The battle is not over. Civil encroachment in the church may take on a different form today, but yet it may come, if it hasn't already. And may the Lord give us either deliverance from such a conflict or else grace to stand for the honour of Christ in the midst of it.